My name's Scott Ritter. I was a Marine Corps intelligence officer who was selected to be among the first inspectors into the Soviet Union back in 1988 to implement the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. I gained a little bit of experience doing on-site inspections in an arms control environment. After the Gulf War, I was asked to join the United Nations Special Commission, where I served for 7.5 years as a weapons inspector and later a chief weapons inspector, helping oversee the disarmament of Iraq's chemical, biological, long-range ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons programs.
In these latest revelations, although they're not that widely reported, Scott, we have from the George Bush, Tony Blair memo, and around that time, apparently the US president told the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, he didn't care who replaced Saddam Hussein, and the pair were plotting a PR campaign to sell the war a year before the invasion. This is way back in 2002. What do you make of these latest revelations about what turned out now to be an illegal war?
Well, a couple of things. One, the date of this most recent memorandum is, I believe, in April of 2002. We know that the U.S. military was planning military operations against Iraq beginning in January, February 2002. How do we know that? Because they started withdrawing troops from Afghanistan to prepare for potential military action. At that time, there was some uncertainty as to the exact date. There were people speaking of military operations beginning sometime in the fall of 2002. This is prior to Bush and Blair agreeing that they needed to go to the United Nations and get some sort of consent from the United Nations to create the ability to form a coalition of the willing, I think is the term they use. There's nothing new in this memorandum. I mean, we know George W. Bush was blithe. That's one way of putting it. He had made up his mind that Saddam Hussein had to go, and that's all he cared about. He didn't care about the consequences, who would replace him or anything. This was as shallow of a decision as one could make. And the shocking thing is that Tony Blair, who is ostensibly supposed to be a more refined politician, went along with this. But then again, the true shocker came in July. I think there was a memorandum by David Manning, who I believe was the ambassador of the United Kingdom, the United States, who reflected on a subsequent conversation between Bush and Blair, in which the president basically said, we need to fix the intelligence to the policy, meaning they had already made the decision to invade Iraq. And they had already made the decision that the pretext would be weapons of mass destruction. And now they needed the intelligence to come out and say there is a weapons of mass destruction threat worthy of military intervention. To me, that's the shocker. The fact that George W. Bush was nonchalant about conflict doesn't surprise me at all. The fact that Tony Blair went along with this. Yeah, that's a surprise until you get to the July memorandum. Then you realize that Tony Blair was as devious a war criminal as George W. Bush.
So who do you think was the senior partner here, the British or the Americans?
Well, there's no doubt it's the Americans. Look, I mean, no offense to Great Britain. You don't have an army worth a damn. You don't have the ability to project power by yourself. You're incapable of doing anything. You are America's poodle. And Tony Blair was a very compliant poodle. When George W. Bush said sit, Tony sat. When he said get up and run, Tony got up and ran.
Why do you think Blair is so much in Bush's thrall and the Pentagon's thrall?
It's not Blair. It's every British prime minister. I mean, Maggie Thatcher may have been the last prime minister that wore pants, so to speak, in terms of her ability to stand up to an American president, which she did with Ronald Reagan on several occasions, and be firm on policy. But the reality is, especially since the aftermath of the Cold War, Great Britain has retreated considerably in terms of its you know, it's power and prestige. It is, again, the British military is a joke with a capital J. Its foreign policy is 100% dependent upon the United States. There hasn't been a prime minister yet who can walk away from the special relationship, because once you eliminate the special relationship with the United States, Great Britain becomes simply a middle power in Europe, which will be rapidly overwhelmed by Germany and France and others. Great Britain by itself is nothing. It only has relevance with the United States, and that's why every prime minister has saddled up and done exactly what the United States wants them to do.
Okay, so I mean, for you, as somebody who was running around on the ground, well, probably sitting in your Humvee or whatever, or your Jeep, I don't know, driving around looking for these weapons of mass destruction, with hindsight, how do you now feel about the fact that you were really looking for something that, you know, Pete, your senior officers knew didn't exist?
Well, you need to understand that I was nobody's fool. I had been reporting on the disarmament status of Iraq in regards to ballistic missiles since 1992, when I wrote a paper based upon extensive inspections that Iraq's operational ballistic missile force had been eliminated. It was all accounted for. The CIA, of course, couldn't accept that, because once you start to close the book on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs, you lose the ability to sustain economic sanctions, which were the cornerstone of the American policy of regime change. Every inspector knew that our search for the truth interfered with American policy. We knew this as early as 1992. So, you know, there was no, you know, wool to be pulled over my eyes. I knew exactly what the game was. You know, my thing was, so long as I was allowed to carry out inspections per the mandate, the politics of how the information that I provided, you know, is not my business. That's the Security Council's business. I just do my job and report. I resigned when they stopped letting me do my job. I resigned when Great Britain and the United States interfered with the work of the inspection to try and shape events on the ground in Iraq. That's not their job. That was my job. That's why I resigned. But I knew from day one, pretty much, that the United States and Great Britain had no intent of ever allowing economic sanctions to be lifted against Iraq, because their goal was regime change, not resolution of a disarmament problem.
What about chemical weapons in Iraq, though?
We can go through all four categories. Chemical weapons, you know, you don't produce chemical weapons, you know, in a basement. They're produced in modern industrial facilities, and we destroyed them. We blew them up during the war and afterwards. Any retained potential stocks on the part of Iraq rapidly degrade, especially the nerve agent that we were concerned about, the sarin gas, the VX gas. This stuff degrades over time. And so at a certain period, somewhere around 1995, 1996, it didn't matter that we could not account for everything that was produced prior to the Gulf War, because even if Iraq held on to it, it was no longer viable. It was just bunk. Same holds true.
So these nerve agents, was Saddam Hussein, surely the Iraqis were not manufacturing this stuff themselves. They must have been buying it in, surely.
No, surely they manufactured it themselves. We know they manufactured it themselves. They produced it. The Iraqis are some of the most well-educated people in the Middle East. Their scientists were all trained in the United States, Great Britain, Germany, France. And these guys knew what they were doing. They acquired the production equipment. They acquired the precursor chemicals. But the ability to manufacture mustard agent, sarin, VX, no, that was purely an Iraqi effort. They imported no finished weaponry when it comes to chemical
weapons. Yeah, because I can remember hearing at the time, Scott, that the British had supplied some of the important precursor chemicals to them knowingly. And in a way, they were kind of being set up there. But anyway, look, let's just move on to the present and the situation between the age-old rivalry between Russia and the West, which seems to be verging on Russophobia, going on, you know, ever since Napoleon, right the way through Hitler, etc. And it seems to be carrying on today with Ukraine. So what do you make of the latest threats? Apparently, the Russians are about to invade Ukraine. But of course, we've still got the in the southeast of Ukraine, this area, the Donbass and Crimea, which many say should be actually part of Ukraine. But the people there apparently have voted, and a lot of them are Russian speaking and are threatened with actually from Kiev being told they're not allowed to speak their own language. They're staying with Russia. So you've got a bit of a potential powder keg in the southeast of the country. So what do you make of these threats, particularly what we keep hearing on the news that Russia is poised to invade Ukraine?
Well, I mean, first of all, the Russians say they're not. So, you know, it's one thing if Russia was pounding the table, threatening to invade tomorrow, and everybody's saying, oh, no, the Russians are getting ready to invade. The Russians are saying we're holding exercises to prepare our troops for any eventuality, but we will not initiate a military invasion of Ukraine. It's just not in our interest to do so. And the Russians are right. There's nothing to be gained from invading Ukraine as the situation currently stands. Russia is pressuring the West, the United States, the European Union, and Ukraine to honor the Minsk agreements of 2015, which provide a diplomatic off-ramp for the current crisis by recognizing the autonomy of Luhansk and Donbass, the two breakaway provinces in eastern Ukraine. But also recognizing the sovereignty of those territories underneath Ukrainian political control. That's the solution. Ukraine doesn't want that. Ukraine wants to dictate the outcome, and Ukraine also wants to reabsorb Crimea. Crimea will never be reabsorbed. The Russians, when they made a decision to annex Crimea, that's a forever decision, irreversible, end of story, full stop. But the big problem here isn't the politics around that. First of all, I'll say this. So long as there's an issue with Donbass, Luhansk, and Crimea, Ukraine will never be a member of NATO. Never. It can't be. NATO rules prohibit it. Because if NATO brought in Ukraine's with these outstanding issues, it's an automatic declaration of war. Because Article 5 of the United Nations Charter calls for collective defense. And if you bring in Ukraine, then Ukraine screams bloody murder about Luhansk and says we're being attacked by the Russians. All of NATO has to go to their help. Ukraine will never be a member of NATO. I'll just say that one more time so it sinks in. Ukraine will never be a member of NATO, not because Russia says it can't be. It's because Ukraine can't be under the current circumstances. Neither can the Republic of Georgia. But you don't tell Ukraine that, because the West keeps breathing false hope in their ears, saying, hey, you could be a member. We could, we could work to resolve these situations. Ukraine believes that it has the backing of the West to be very aggressive with the Russians. Ukraine believes that it doesn't have to abide by the Minsk agreements. Ukraine believes that it can launch a military operation against Donbass and Luhansk and forcibly beat down these separatists. That won't happen either. One of the reasons why the Russians are massing 100,000 troops on the border is that if Ukraine is stupid enough to launch an attack against Luhansk or Donbass or even Crimea, Russia will annihilate it. Lance the boil, destroy Ukraine, destroy their military. It will happen in less than a week. And there's nothing NATO or the West can do about it, nothing the United States can do about it. NATO is a paper tiger. We talked earlier about the state of the British military. It is a joke. The Brits couldn't even mobilize a single armored brigade worthy of the name. Can't do it. Impossible. Neither can the Germans, by the way. The Germans had to cannibalize their entire armored force to get one armored battalion capable of deploying to the Baltic states as part of these so-called battle group formations put forward by NATO to intimidate Russia. 5,000 troops. The Russians aren't scared by this because, as I said, not only can the Russians destroy all of the Ukrainian military in less than a week, they can destroy the entire NATO military power in Eastern Europe in less than 2 weeks. NATO's war gamed this out many times, and every single time, without fail, the Russians destroy NATO, recapture the Baltic states in less than a week, have troops on the doorsteps of Warsaw in 2 weeks, and there's nothing NATO can do to stop it. America says, oh, no, we'll deploy more troops. This, we don't have troops to deploy. I mean, it's, you know, we have an armor brigade in Europe right now, and then we have prepositioned stocks for a second brigade. That's it. To get a third brigade, we require 6 to 8 months mobilization notification. That's not rapid response. I mean, the war would be over. Europe would be captured by the Russians by the time we were able to get a third brigade over there. So, you know, we're basically the West has boxed itself in by its own rhetoric here. They say that NATO has an open door policy, that any nation that qualifies for NATO membership should be allowed to join NATO. That's why NATO violated the oral agreement given by James Baker, by German foreign ministers, by French foreign ministers, and other members of NATO, that if the Russians, then the Soviets, allowed Germany to reunified and to have Germany remain as a NATO state, NATO would not expand its military presence 1 inch eastward. He lied. They've expanded right up to the doorstep of Russia, and Russia's had it. Russia says no more. It will not be allowed to stand. Ukraine will never be allowed to be a member of NATO. That's just the way it is, and there's nothing the West can do. And, you know, there's all this talk about sanctions. We're going to sanction Russia if they go into Ukraine. Really? That's why the Department of Treasury has sent a memo to President Biden saying, if you sanction Russia the way you intend to, it will hurt the United States and it will hurt Europe far more than it hurts Russia. Europe is 100% dependent upon, not 100%, but significantly dependent upon Russia for its energy requirements. And if, you know, if Europe goes along with, for instance, removing Russia from the SWIFT banking system, the communication system that allows for the rapid and secure transfer of money between banks, they will be violating the terms of the contract for the delivery of energy, because those contracts call for specific methods of payment that use the SWIFT system. So if Europe voluntarily annuls that, they've annulled their contract, and Russia will cease and desist the shipment of all energy, not because it violated a contract, but because Europe violated their contracts, and then Europe will starve to death. You know, last time I checked, Europe is a collection of ostensible democracies. Every single one of their leaders was voted into power by a constituency that said, you're going to do well by us. So, you know, these guys go and buy into a policy that commits economic suicide instantaneously. They won't be in power very long. And the last time I checked, in a democracy, there's not too many democratically elected leaders that are willing to commit political suicide in support of a losing cause. So the United States sits here and barks about how we have everybody lining up behind us. We have nobody lining up behind us. They say all the right words at NATO. They say all the right words at the OSCE. They say all the right words at the European Union. But then Germany, France, and Great Britain are all making phone calls to the Russians talking about how we can fix this thing behind the American back. Because nobody supports what the United States is doing today. Nobody. Except maybe the Poles.
Maybe the Poles? Why?
Eastern Europe, the Poles and the Balts hate the Russians. And in fact, they're the nations in the expansion of NATO that represent the destruction, the death of NATO. They will destroy NATO for their own selfish reasons. You know, there used to be a treaty called the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty that controlled the number of conventional forces that were deployed in the critical borderland regions. When NATO allowed the Baltic states in, because the Baltic states had not been part of the original Conventional Forces in Europe treaty, NATO told the Russians their forces don't count. The armies and the forces that we deploy in the Baltic states don't count towards the Conventional Forces in Europe, which means that they could build up whatever they wanted right on Russia's border, and Russia wasn't allowed to respond. The Russians said, you're insane, and withdrew from the treaty. You know, the Baltic states and Poland are the ones pumping up this current crisis. They're the ones demanding support for Ukraine. And that's ironic, given the fact that modern Ukraine, the western half of modern Ukraine, is Poland. I mean, people forget that at the end of World War II, in a nifty little territorial swap, the Russians gave Poland, it took a huge chunk of Poland, but then replaced it with a huge chunk of Prussia and redrew the Polish map. You know, but the people who reside in Western Ukraine today are Poles. They don't associate with Kiev. They don't believe in any of this. And there's some sort of fantasy that somehow if Ukraine joins Poland, that the Poles will be able to reunite with Poland. I mean, so this is the kind of insanity that's driving NATO policy. It's inconsistent with everything NATO claims to stand for, and it's going to lead to a major league crisis.
That crisis was being discussed by NATO leaders, the US leaders, and the Russians last week. And we're looking really at a situation here where, very, very quickly, if Kiev suddenly decides, right, we're going to recognize the separatist areas of Lugansk and Donbass and Crimea, we are now a completely separate sovereign country. We've been wanting to join NATO for a long time. NATO have been wanting to expand their influence eastwards as far as close as they can to Moscow. And of course, Ukraine is very close. We're getting very close to Moscow there. If something like that happens, surely the Russians, that they're, you know, they would be completely legitimate in Ukraine as saying now we're a completely separate sovereign country. We're not part of these other sections, so now we can join NATO. What we would see very quickly, and as we have seen in other areas of Eastern Europe, missiles being brought up, potentially nuclear weapons being brought up very close to Moscow. So I wonder whether you think that that's a likelihood and how far it's already gone, because that's Cuban Missile Crisis territory, Scott.
Well, again, I'll just reiterate that Ukraine will never become a member of NATO, ever. It can't happen. It won't happen. But let's just hypothesize and say that it does. NATO nuclear weapons are part of a NATO nuclear policy. And so for any nuclear weapons to be stored in Ukraine would require the support of all 30 nations of NATO. And that's just not going to happen. Germany would veto it in a heartbeat, which means the United States would then have to enter a bilateral nuclear agreement with Ukraine, which be a violation of the nuclear nonproliferation treaty. None of this will happen overnight, and all of it will result in instantaneous military response from Russia. Russia right now, as I said, can destroy Ukraine within a week. Ukraine will disappear off the face of the earth as a modern functioning nation state. Its military will be either dead or prisoners. All that beautiful equipment that's being flown in right now from Great Britain will go into Russian warehouses. And Russia thanks the American taxpayer and the British taxpayer very much for the hundreds of millions of dollars of brand new equipment that you're giving to Russia. I mean, one only has to take a look at the billions of dollars that we provided the Afghan government, and the Afghan army, and saw what happens there. It's all Taliban owned. And the Russians are far more capable than the Taliban. So Russia will own all of this equipment. They'll spend more time processing Ukrainian prisoners of war than killing Ukrainians. And the Ukrainian government will disappear. All their industrial infrastructure will disappear. And there will be this rotting hulk of a country left for Europe to take care of, because Russia's not going to occupy it. They're just going to destroy it. And that's it. So I'm not worried about any of that. There's not going to be any missiles in Ukraine. There's not going to be any nuclear weapons in Ukraine. There's going to be nothing, because Russia's made it clear it won't be allowed to happen. Russia's not going to sit around and let NATO dictate the timeline here. You know, we talk about all these negotiations have taken place. You know, the arrogance of the United States, Great Britain, the European Union, of saying, you know, we're setting a table and we're allowing the Russians to come to this table. That game has changed. The table is being set by Russia. The menu is being determined by Russia, and Russia is inviting us to the table. That's how this game is working today. Russia's dictating the solution, and they're making it clear they will not accept major deviations from this. Yes, there's room for compromise, but the compromise will not violate any of the fundamental security guarantees Russia demands from this, and the solutions will not be something that that causes Russia to spend an inordinate amount of time. Russia's not going to give the West time. This problem will be resolved on Russia's timeline, and it's a much shorter timeline than the West thinks.
Well, yeah, hang on though, Scott, because the NATO has already got its missile defense shield in Romania and Poland. So, surely it's only, in a way, a tick box exercise that they might start installing these. They call it a defensive system, but of course it's nuclear capable. And it's almost a tick box exercise to add these missiles into Ukraine too, which is a fraction closer to Moscow.
It would take months to install an Aegis Ashore Mark 41 missile defense system. But while they tried to install that in Ukraine, the first thing that would happen is that Russia would fire two hypersonic non-nuclear missiles, and the Ukrainian missile site or the Polish missile site and the Romanian missile site would be destroyed. It's a joke. I mean, let's just stop pretending that these are real military capabilities. There are two points on the ground that are well known to Russia, and those points on the ground will cease to exist in any real military confrontation. Russia is not going to allow the West to accumulate that kind of offensive strike power that threatens Russia. The bigger danger isn't these two Aegis Ashore systems, which are just political. They're purely done for political visibility. They're not real military systems. They won't survive day one, hour one, minute one in any real war with Russia.
Yeah, but hang on, Scott. Hang on, because the Russians are saying that these missile sites are potentially first strike nuclear capable of hitting Russia.
Well, the Russians are saying that because Russia has been right all along. When these systems were deployed, Russia said these are not anti-ballistic missile systems. These are systems taken from U.S. naval warships. And when they're on warships, they can be used to fire nuclear-capable cruise missiles. And now that the Navy has redesigned its surface-to-air missiles to be surface-to-surface missiles called Typhoon, they all fit in the same canisters that are loaded. So the capability is there for the United States to load the launch canisters with Tomahawk missiles and Typhoon missiles, et cetera. That's true. But the reality is these are fixed known locations. Okay, I've been doing war for a long time, and I'm telling you right now, they won't live past minute one. Hey, there's not redundancy. There's only like 50 of them, you know, out there. There's two. And we know the Russians know where they are. And they've targeted and they will be eliminated. The bigger threat comes in the form of, for instance, if you take the Mark 41 system and make it mobile. If you now take that same launch canister and you put it on a trailer that can be moved around, that's what the Typhoon system is that they're talking about deploying sometime in 2023, 2024. Or later this year, we have something called Dark Eagle, which is a hypersonic missile system that is scheduled to be deployed in Europe. These are far more dangerous systems that the Russians are truly worried about because they're mobile, they're relocatable, they're more difficult to target. And if the United States deploys these and Europe accepts these weapons, then the Russians say that we will respond in kind, meaning that they will deploy a similar technology throughout, you know, the forward areas of Western Russia that threatens the totality of Europe. We'll be back to the 1980s, where Russian SS-20 missiles targeted every major European city with a 100 to 150 megaton or kiloton warhead, meaning Paris, goodbye, London, goodbye, every city, goodbye. We're going to return to that. You know, we had walked away from that insanity at one point, and now, thanks to the United States, we may be right back there.
Well, why is it that the European Union and European governments, I wouldn't necessarily say European people, have accepted this situation where U.S. policy in Europe as it means that so many European cities could be obliterated?
Because NATO fell for the promise of perpetual American military support. You know, at the end of the Cold War, the United States insisted that NATO continue to exist. Not only that it would expand, that it would become more than a military alliance, it would become a political alliance, things of this nature. The NATO militaries have all degenerated since that time. They've rotted. They're not well funded. There's no the new equipment isn't coming in. They've shrunk. And it was all done on the premise that America will always be there. America, the sole remaining superpower. And this is something that, you know, could be believed in the 1990s when Russia was, you know, struggling with their ridiculous president, Boris Yeltsin, who was subservient to everything the Americans and the Europeans wanted him to do, who humiliated Russia and humiliated himself at the feet of Bill Clinton. You know, but Vladimir Putin isn't playing that game, and Vladimir Putin has rebuilt Russia. The problem is the Europeans have bought into the notion of American supremacy. But, you know, they had to sit there and watch the United States commit military suicide in the Middle East for 20 years in the endless wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which compelled the United States to switch from being the finest large-scale conventional military fighting force the world has ever seen to being a bunch of low-intensity conflict door kickers who specialize in killing goat herders and civilians, but incapable of waging meaningful ground combat in Europe. Europe bought in the premise of American supremacy, military supremacy. It's no longer there. Now they're trapped. They're trapped politically because they can't walk away from the United States. They need the United States to step up and deliver, but the United States is incapable of stepping up and delivering.
Well, I'm just amazed that maybe you can help explain this. I know you're a military man, but obviously quite a lot of importance is put by the populations in the democratic world on things like energy prices. Now, if we were to just literally flick a switch, we could start getting Russian gas very, very cheaply here in Britain. At the moment, we're facing a doubling of energy bills in Britain and in some parts of Europe, even more. So why is it that Europe doesn't have the wherewithal to flick this switch and start taking some Russian gas and stand up to American pressure?
Well, again, it comes down to, political courage. Europe has been weaned at the American breast, and they don't know how to leave home. They're the proverbial 30-year-old kid living in their parents' basement, incapable of getting a job, incapable of doing anything on their own, totally dependent upon the parents. That's the reality of Europe today. I mean, with all due respect to Europeans, you're pathetic, every single one of you. You need to grow up. You need to assert yourselves. And you need to be able to say no to, an irresponsible American power. I mean, if there's anybody in Europe today that can defend what the United States has done and is doing, then you deserve what you're going to get. Europe has the ability to declare independence, but to do so would require them to go out into the world, not like adults. And when you walk away from the United States, that means you're going to be entering a relationship with other nations, to include Russia, whom you've demonized for the past 30 years. And that's the real problem, is that European politicians are conditioned to view Russia and everything Russian as evil. And therefore, they don't have the tool set to responsibly deal with Russia and put Russia in its proper perspective.
We started by talking about the latest revelations about the Iraq war in the run-up to that, which you were very much on the ground involved in, not the memo, Scott. But anyway, you were talking there about ballistic missiles, and we keep hearing about Iranian ballistic missiles and the dangers of those. Now, we don't hear quite so much, do we, about the Israeli nuclear weapons. So I wonder what you think of state of play is there, because it does seem as if the Israeli government, now Netanyahu's gone, has not in any way stopped the rhetoric about trying to get a war started. They're actually open. They actually want a war with Iran. And is that going to happen, do you think?
Well, I think the Israelis have been pushing for a conflict with Iran verbally as a means of pressuring the United States, meaning that, hey, America, if you don't take a harder line with Iran or join us in our war against Iran, we'll have to take action by ourselves. But the Israeli military is incapable of initiating and sustaining meaningful military action against Iran. They just don't have the military to do it. Iran's a long way away. It would require a tremendous effort that Israel is incapable of sustaining. They can pump in 16 fighters on a one-time good deal. That's it. Then they've got nothing, because as those fighters are coming home, over their head will come in Iranian missiles, and these aren't Iraqi Scuds that land 8 miles away from their intended target. These are missiles that the Iranians approved in their attack in 2021, I believe, against Al Asad Air Base, where they showed they are precision weapons. They take out bunkers. They'll take out buildings. They'll take out rooms. They'll take out automobiles. That's how good they are. And they've got lots of them. So Israel would be destroyed. And I mean, literally, Israel wouldn't know what hit it. And it wouldn't just be Iranian missiles. Hezbollah has similar missile capabilities. Hezbollah's a lot closer, and Hezbollah would join the fight. So Israel knows that if it starts the war against Iran, it's not going to end on the terms that Israel thinks it will. Now, Israel does have nuclear weapons, and that serves as a deterrence against Iran launching a first strike. But if Israel attacks Iran, then everything Iran does is retaliatory in nature, and it'll be very difficult for Israel to justify to the world why it suddenly used nuclear weapons against against Iran.
Don't you think that the fact that, as we saw in the 1970s, when Israel is under threat, they know that even if they do launch a war and it looks like they're going to lose, that the U.S. will come to their aid?
That was then, this is now. I don't think if Israel used nuclear weapons in a precipitous manner, the U.S. is going to come to their aid.
Well, okay, so maybe not nuclear, maybe a conventional war that the Israelis are losing. Surely, you know, that's a bit of a gambit, but surely the Israelis can calculate on the U.S. coming to their aid.
Well, the United States nor Europe, I believe, will allow Israel to be destroyed. So, yes, they can count on that. But the humiliation of having to rely on the United States to save them from Iran or Hezbollah would be politically devastating for any Israeli politician, and it would forever change the geopolitical reality in the Middle East. So right now, Israel enjoys a certain amount of mystique attached to it. But if it goes to war against Iran and doesn't prevail, that mystique is blown, and that changes everything. Attitude will change. The attitude of the people who live in Gaza will change. The people who are in the West Bank will change. And Israel will find itself in a much more difficult situation than it faces now.
Anyone listening to this, Scott, will know that this is not the BBC. It's not CNN they're listening to. We don't see too much of you on these big international channels, but you are, I think, on some others like RT. Could you just give us finally a little hint as to where you think a good place is to get your international news? And possibly even, if you'd like, you can plug your Deal Breaker book.
Well, I mean, you know, I've written a number of books. Deal Breaker deals with the Iranian nuclear situation. Scorpion King deals with America's nuclear weapons policies. Amazon sells those. Look, news today, I think that the best thing that anybody could do is to expose themselves to as great a variety of independent media as possible. Understanding that a lot of independent media has a bias built in. But if you know what that bias is going in, that's okay. You can filter that out as you weigh different facts that are presented. But if you allow yourself to be lured into the addictive simplicity of mainstream media, whether it be the BBC or CNN, you're going to be spoon-fed a narrative that the establishment wants you to have. And it's a narcotic-based narrative, meaning that it's purposely designed to stupidify the audience, have them sit there brain dead and do nothing. It's imperative people reach out and expand their horizons. I mean, programs like this, where you can get, voices that you might not hear, points of view that you're not hear. Or if you're going to do, for instance, I used to like to go to England and read the different newspapers. I'd get all of them laid out on my table in the morning. And I knew that, when I read The Guardian, I'm getting this spin. When I read The Independent, I'm getting this spin. But by reading them, I get different perspectives, and then I get to formulate my own opinion. And I think that's the approach that people have to take. To be an informed citizen is hard work. It's not easy. You can't expect someone to do it for you. So I don't think there's any one source or kind of source for people to tune into. I think people are going to have to do the hard work and figure out where they need to go to get the facts necessary for them to form their own opinions.
Okay, what's your latest book and what's it about?
The most recently published book is Scorpion King. It's America's Dangerous Addiction to Nuclear Weapons from FDR to Donald Trump. I'm working on, I just finished a book on the INF Treaty and the first 3 years of the INF Treaty and how that was implemented. We'll hopefully see that published sometime in the next year.
Okay, Scott Ritter, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.